I grew up with a first cousin who's like my sister, who was born with cerebral palsy. And I said, Malini, what do you want for your birthday? And she said, I just want to have sex.
I think the problem with a lot of films on disability, especially in India, is that we tend to glorify the person, make them very angelic and sweet, whereas Laila is just another horny teenager.
In the South Asian gay rights movement, it was very uncomfortable when you're saying you're bisexual, because it was like, well, that's really convenient, you're sitting on the fence.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Hong Kong puts diversity in the pink, hundreds detained for being proud in Kampala, and disability meets sexuality for a margarita with a straw. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Carol Myers.
And I'm Jason Proctor.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending October 1st, 2016. More than 10,000 people were pretty in pink on September 25th at the third incarnation of Pink Dot Hong Kong, the city's LGBTI carnival. The annual celebration of diversity, equality, and love was held in its first 2 years at Tamer Park, but was relocated this year to the more pet-friendly West Kowloon Cultural District waterfront, organizers explained, to accommodate activities for everyone, young and old. Pink Dot Hong Kong enjoyed the support of a number of notable entertainers, celebrities, corporate sponsors, and diplomats, along with the chairperson of the city's Equal Opportunities Commission. The assembled pink-attired participants formed a huge human pink dot, providing some breathtaking aerial photos. Abby Lee was one of the organizers. Pink Dot represents the diversity of not only the LGBTI community, she said, but of our allies, friends, families, colleagues, and even our pets. Another organizer, Anthony Wong, noted that people are not afraid to step out and show they are members of the LGBTI community. And the most important thing, he added, is that more and more non-LGBTI people are willing to join us and show their support for equality and diversity. The first Pink Dot was held in Singapore in 2009. It spread to Hong Kong in 2014. Both events attract larger and larger crowds each year and help promote LGBTI rights across the region.
But Uganda's oxymoronically named ethics minister, Simon Lokodu, made good on his threat earlier in the week to arrest anyone who tried to hold an LGBT pride celebration in his country. Police shut down such an effort on September 24th that had attracted more than 100 people to a beach on Lake Victoria outside the Ugandan capital, Kampala, before the celebration could even begin. Leading Ugandan activist Frank Mugisha told reporters that most of the attendees were ordered into minibuses and escorted to a police station, apparently for questioning. One frightened young man jumped off a moving minibus on the way and was critically injured. Mugisha said that everyone on the bus was traumatized. All the detainees were later released without charge. Ugandan police disrupted a pride-related trans beauty pageant at a Kampala nightclub in August that also led to catch-and-release detentions. That raid prompted organizers to postpone further pride events until September, clearly with no better outcome. LGBT people, and those perceived to be, face official government hostility and entrenched societal homophobia in Uganda, enhanced by a number of far-right U.S. evangelicals who have made regular visits to the country peddling debunked Pray the Gay Away programs. Private, consensual, adult gay sex is illegal in the East African nation under a colonial-era law that already penalizes acts of gross indecency with lengthy prison terms. Proponents of a bill first introduced in 2009 to punish so-called aggravated homosexuality with execution continue to push a less severe but equally repressive version in Parliament. Uganda's highest court declared a 2014 version of the Anti-Homosexuality Act to be unconstitutional.
Masamare, a four-day film, art, and performance festival celebrating LGBT Afro-Caribbean culture, was scheduled to kick off on September 27th in the Haitian capital of Port-au-Prince. But the entire event, organized by the country's leading LGBT advocacy group, Courage, was shut down by the government after organizers in the hosting venues were threatened with violence, including murderous attacks and arson. Massamati was launched in 2009 in Montreal and has also been successfully held in Brussels. This was to have been the first Massamati to be held in Haiti. Port-au-Prince Police Commissioner Jean Détant-Léger confirmed to reporters that he had issued the order to cancel the festival. He cited the need to protect public safety and Haiti's moral and social values. In a local broadcast interview, Léger also claimed to be acting on a complaint from several senators who charged that the queer Afro-Caribbean festival would be a provocation and a challenge to the traditional family model. Although there are no laws criminalizing same-gender sex in Haiti, the country's LGBT citizens remain largely underground because of government repression and social stigma. LGBT Haitians, or those perceived to be, are frequent victims of mob violence. At least two people died recently in murderous anti-queer assaults in Port-au-Prince.
The Times of India reported this week that hundreds of people were arrested last year for violating the country's colonial-era anti-gay Penal Code Section 377, which outlaws carnal intercourse against the order of nature. After sexual and gender minorities celebrated a lower court ruling declaring Section 377 to be unconstitutional, the nation's Supreme Court overturned that decision in 2013. The Times says that data from India's National Crime Records Bureau reveal that arrests have surged since then. There were 1,491 Section 377 arrests in 2015. Nearly all of those were men, though 207 minors and 16 women were among those arrested under the law. In 814 cases, the crimes were committed against children. The remaining crimes were committed by adults, but the report does not specify the number of times that the acts were not consensual. The law punishes violations of the statute with up to 10 years in prison. India's Supreme Court refused to hear a petition challenging the law in June. A final appeal to the High Court to reverse the decision, known as a curative petition, is pending. Defenders of the status quo have always insisted that the law can remain on the books because no one ever gets arrested under it. Despite the obvious contradiction, MPs in Prime Minister Narendra Modi's governing Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party have consistently rejected attempts to repeal the specific anti-gay provisions of the law while maintaining the penalties in Section 377 for sex with minors. A private member's bill to that end by an opposition National Congress Party MP lost by a vote of 58-14 in March.
In the latest HB2-related North Carolina news, some 60 major investment groups representing more than $2 trillion in managed assets joined several high-profile entertainers, professional and collegiate sports associations, and more than 200 businesses in calling for the U.S. state to repeal its discriminatory law. HB2 forbids local governments from passing ordinances banning anti-LGBT bias and requires trans people to use birth certificate-based public bathrooms. Matt Patsky, Chief Executive Officer of Trillium Asset Management, said at a September 26 news conference that, without repeal, North Carolina is headed for a state government-inflected recession.
Officials in a number of other states and several cities have banned non-essential government travel to North Carolina to protest HB2. California, which boasts the world's sixth largest economy, has taken an additional step by also banning non-essential government-funded travel to Mississippi and other states with discriminatory anti-LGBT laws. State Assemblyman Evan Lowe wrote the legislation that was signed into law by Governor Jerry Brown this week. All North Carolina travel bans have been issued by chief executives, such as governors or mayors. Assemblyman Lowe's measure makes California's the first state legislature in the U.S. to pass a law banning travel to all states that discriminate against gender and sexual minorities.
Meanwhile, the Board of Supervisors for the City and County of San Francisco took it even further on September 27th by voting unanimously to stop doing business with companies headquartered in states that specifically deny civil rights protection to LGBT people. The measure doesn't affect existing contracts with companies based in those states, but will likely prevent the city from renewing them. Bank of America is among the major companies that could be affected by the new ordinance. It was actually founded in San Francisco, but moved its headquarters to Charlotte, North Carolina in 1998 after merging with Nations Bank. Bank of America has an $8 million depository and payroll services contract with San Francisco that expires in August 2018.
And finally, Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore set some sort of judicial record this week by being suspended from office without pay for a second time. The 9-member Alabama Court of the Judiciary voted unanimously to remove him from the bench, this time for defying the U.S. Supreme Court's June 2015 civil marriage equality ruling by telling state probate judges to continue to deny marriage licenses to same-gender couples. The ethics panel removed the far-right Republican from office in 2003 because he refused a federal court order to tear down a Ten Commandments monument he'd installed at the state judicial building. Voters astonishingly re-elected him as Chief Justice in 2012 after he lost a race for the GOP gubernatorial nomination. Moore has repeatedly warned that opening civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples would destroy our country. One of his ardent supporters said his removal amounted to the persecution of a Christian official. The suspension by the ethics panel this week removes Moore for the rest of his current term, which was to run through 2018. Republican Governor Robert Bentley will appoint a replacement to fill out the rest of his term. Moore's judicial career is virtually over. State law forbids the now 69-year-old jurist from running for Chief Justice again because of his age.
Goodbye.
That's NewsWrap for the week ending October 1st, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Jason Proctor.
And I'm Carol Myers.
You say goodbye, and I say hello. Hello, hello.
On the Society page, love has again found Edie Windsor. Windsor is the lesbian widow whose inheritance rights lawsuit led to the U.S. Supreme Court's first decision against DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, in 2013. The now 87-year-old former plaintiff tied a new knot on September 26th, marrying 51-year-old investment banker and activist Judith Kaysen. Windsor said, "I was empty, and then this woman walked into my life. I didn't think it would happen again, and it did. She is it."
Children born today will grow up in a world without DOMA.
Hello, I'm Robbie Kaplan, the author of Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. And you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
An unexpected coming-of-age story confronts disability in South Asian culture with a step beyond Bollywood and a leap for bi visibility. Correspondent Abby Dees spoke with two of the people behind the film.
Coming soon to a good art house theater near you, or maybe your DVD player, is the award-winning feature film Margarita with a Straw, about a young woman's coming-of-age and sexual discovery. I'm fortunate to be here with the film's writer and director, Shonali Bose, and its star, Kalki Kekla.
Correct.
Yay, I got it.
Thanks for getting my name right.
Shonali, people know you best for pretty unflinching work about social justice and political struggle. In this country, I think in particular, the feature film Amu, the story of a U.S.-raised Indian woman returning to India to discover her family's role in the 1984 massacre of thousands of Sikhs in Delhi after the assassination of Indira Gandhi. I was surprised when I saw this film because it seemed at first glance to be the opposite. It was a gentle coming-of-age story. Was that something that you wanted to do after that kind of experience, or how did this film come to life?
It's very deeply personal in that sense, you're right. Although I don't know if you've seen Amu, like Amu is also on a hardcore political issue, but it's completely buried in the film. Like it's a narrative drama that is not really like overtly political. So in this also, I feel there are issues of disability and sexuality, given that it's illegal to be gay in our country, that are so important and very as up there as genocide, I think. But again, it's about the narrative. Going beyond that, it was a very personal narrative for me because I grew up with a first cousin who's like my sister, just a year younger than me, who was born with cerebral palsy. And we were having this conversation. I was 40, she was 39. We were in a pub in London. She always outdrinks me. And I said, Malini, what do you want for your 40th birthday? It's the best birthday ever. And she said, I just want to have sex. And that was the inspiration, that thought that... Actually, when we were teenagers, I was very conscious that she was so romantic and was dying to have a date. And I thought about it a lot. And then I guess I didn't think about it anymore because I couldn't. I didn't know what to do about it. And I put it away because she was successful. She was studying in London. She wrote a novel. So I put that thought away saying it's okay. But it's not okay. It's not okay at all. It's a deep yearning that she has. And I'm sure many, many disabled people do. So that was the inspiration to write a story. And I thought it would be nice to do it as a coming of age of a teenager so that it feels universal, so that you cease to think of it as a disabled person's yearning, but as any teenager coming of age and falling in love and going through the ups and downs.
How do you describe the film for people who haven't seen it yet?
It's a coming of age love story, which is upbeat. And in India, our marketing, we were very conscious because we had a huge release in India and we always were like, this is like a Bollywood film. That was we were like, it's a happy love story Bollywood film, you know.
Yeah, it's a rom-com.
She used to say it's a rom-com.
But it's got some really wonderful bittersweet elements to it. Mm. I mean, it's not just a prance.
No,
I really, really feel for the lead character, Lila. And you play Lila. Did you consult with your cousin when you were making the film, or was this sort of a surprise?
She read every single draft of the script, which I wrote 20 drafts or 30 drafts, I think. So she was involved right from the beginning. And Kalki will tell you more about this, but I introduced them very soon after I cast Kalki. I did that because I wanted her to experience and imbibe Malini's joie de vivre and understand how Malini saw in her own skin what she goes through. And that relationship, I think, was something very special for her.
What was it like, Kalki, to meet her?
Well, the first meeting was actually awful because Malini was feeling like a science experiment, I think. Because the first time we met, it was like asking her 100 questions about cerebral palsy and about her life and how she walks and how she talks and everything. And I think it was really tough the first time. And I was like, she was feeling very conscious.
She howled and howled. My father told me, who's her uncle, she howled and howled after that. And I felt just appalled. I've always grown up with her not thinking of her disability because that's how we've been brought up. And so just was insensitive in just asking certain technical specific questions. And
which I think if I wasn't there, would have been fine. But
right.
Because it was a new person observing her, I think she got really conscious. So anyway, that first meeting was really tough. But after that, we kind of became friends on our own terms rather than through Sonali. I started hanging out with her, got drunk with her, as Malini loves to drink.
Does she like margaritas?
She's more a whiskey drinker.
Oh, okay.
I did margarita because I'm just a sweet, fluffy cocktail type of person, and she's like a hardcore drinker.
But she has a straw with it, you know. So I remember
whiskey
drinking
with straw.
Her whiskey with a straw, and basically, like, we hung out in her workplace. We hung out where she works in a center for disability. We hung out at home with her and out in public, and so I got to see her in these very, very different situations and how different things affect a person, especially in India with disability. We're so not used to seeing our disabled outside. There's still so much just from a basic infrastructural level that people don't go out much who are disabled. So when I went out to the theater with her, for example, like, you know, a lot of people just staring and also not being educated on what she had. So, you know, treating her, infantilizing her like she's a child, whereas, you know, she's been to Oxford, she's written a book.
She's a pretty badass.
Person. Yeah.
I read a little bit about her.
So all of that, I really got to see close up. And she's also somebody who's got a great sense of humor. And I think that was really important in finding for Lila as well, that, you know, that she doesn't feel sorry for herself, that she does mess up and she's a normal person. Like, I think the problem with a lot of films on disability, especially in India, is that we tend to glorify the person, make them very angelic and sweet, whereas Lila is just another horny teenager with issues and problems and makes mistakes, you know. So that was really, really refreshing.
I was really conscious of that. I mean, there's a term for it, it's called inspiration porn, and I really was because the whole thing is that the disabled have to be inspiring. And for me, creating a gray character was very important because then it's a three-dimensional person who you identify with. So Lila is in no way perfect.
The film is very much focused on her sexual awakening. And I was quite aware that when I first saw in the film her sexuality coming onto screen, and it was not overt, it was not graphic or anything, it was very, very tastefully done and honest, I felt uncomfortable. And I was really bothered by the fact that I was uncomfortable, because I have stood up in public spaces and said every woman has a right to claim and enjoy her sexuality. And by the end of the film, I'm happy to report that that discomfort had gone away. It kind of reminded me when I first started seeing same-sex sexual imagery in film. That same discomfort, it seemed so intimate because I wasn't used to seeing it. And I think that was just it. Were you aware that that would be a response that people would have? I don't think I'm alone.
No, leave alone the response, Abby. Like, I think you might be referring to the scene. It's the very first time we see her being sexual. She's actually masturbating. That is something we never see in cinema. Leave alone a disabled person in a wheelchair masturbating. A woman masturbating.
Yeah.
And it was so tastefully done, as you said, because we were just on her back. For me, writing it and directing it, I felt uncomfortable because it's an intimate space. I myself had an inhibition. I was felt inhibited to put it on screens, and I had to struggle with it, that should I keep it, should I not, then thinking of my audience, because I myself was feeling that. But this is so important. It's sacred and important, and we've done it beautifully, and therefore I must keep it.
And it's true.
Yes.
I'm Edmund White. It is the overwhelming international flavor of the lesbian and gay rights movement that has proved so powerful over the past couple of decades. And one radio program has been there to record, to inform, and to entertain. So please keep listening to This Way Out on this station.
This is Abby Dees, and I'm talking with Shanali Bose, the writer and director of the independent film Margarita with a Straw, as well as the film's star, Kalki Kekla. Margarita with a Straw is available now on DVD and streaming on Netflix and Amazon Video. We've talked about the sexuality, but there's so many things in this film that we're not used to seeing. We're not used to seeing women's sexuality. We're still not, in that sort of honest, personal way, in a non-objectified way. We're not used to seeing the sexuality of the disabled. We're also not used to seeing images of bisexuality. And I know that in this country, they still cause comment. I'm wondering how these things were perceived in India.
I want to just talk about why I wrote it, though, before
sure.
I get to the perception in India.
Because
the first 10 drafts of the script for the whole first year didn't have Laila being bisexual. Or in those first 10 drafts, Laila didn't even have sex with the man. It was just the masturbation, kissing, but not sex, because he had to take her to the bathroom. And when he did that, when they came back to making out, he couldn't. And that was a comment was told to me at the Sundance Lab, that why do you feel your character doesn't have sex? She never has sex in the film. And I was like, because my sister has never had the opportunity to have sex, and she's always been rejected because of her body, and I was being true to her story. And then they said, but, you know, there are others who have, and so you need to think about that. And also that he takes her to the bathroom, and he gets turned off, and I'll never forget, she said, honey, that is such a sexy thing. He's taking her panties off.
Yeah,
it's sexy. Why will he get turned off? I was like, oh, my God, I have to really stretch my brain that huge. So... And I was like, yes, I was restricting myself to Malini, and I wasn't putting myself in the script or other things in the script. So for me as a writer, I always feel the most honest you can be is when you put yourself in all the characters, even the antagonists, even men, others who you are not, because you will then embody them with things that can come out from your own life. So I then started writing like that. But I was not conscious. I just had made that decision, and I started writing in a deep way. And Laila and Khanum is a person who's blind in the film and is out and out gay person from Pakistan, actually. Came out to her parents when she was 14 in the script. She lives in New York, and she's very comfortable with her sexuality and her disability. She's the inspirational character, I feel like, the empowered person. And Laila is still uncomfortable with both her sexuality and disability. So Khanum hits on Laila. And at this point, I'm writing the scene, and Laila speaks to me as I'm writing, as a writer. And Laila is like, are you kidding me? This is a gorgeous, amazing person. Why won't I have sex with her? And I was like, oh, this is what you yearn for as a writer, that your characters speak to you. Laila is speaking to me. I've reached that nirvana where my character is speaking to me. And I wrote that. And then much later, of course, I understood. So when I myself was exactly the same age as Laila, I was 19. And my very first sexual experience was with a woman. In fact, she was at UC Berkeley and had come to India, Christian, and was so uncomfortable with it. Was from Berkeley campus, fully aware of sexuality and gay rights. I grew up in a very sort of sheltered, puritanical, innocent environment. I wasn't even aware of these things. I was 19. I had never had sex with anybody. And we fell in love. And it was so natural for me to be in a relationship with her and our lovemaking and everything. She was ashamed of it because it was against her Christianity. And she came back to America. She got married to a man. And I'm proud to say now she ended her marriage. She's with a woman, with her partner, and they have two children. And she's right out there in the gay rights movement. And I was like, don't forget an Indian, innocent Indian took you on that path. But it was my own. And after that, I remained an active bisexual. Like, I was married to a man, but I've also had other women. And so I feel like, for me, so when I came to the United States, then I came soon after, and at that time, at least in the South Asian gay rights movement, which I immediately was part of, it was very uncomfortable when you're saying you're bisexual, because it was like, well, that's really convenient. You're sitting on the fence. And I'm with my heart and soul, not because of me, like just to support the gay rights movement. Like I was just like, even if I'm straight, I'll say I'm gay, because I always felt left out that, well, I'm not really gay, but I couldn't pretend that. I was just like, well, I am bisexual. And that made me make that choice to make Lila bisexual versus just, I mean, could have made them both just gay, but I made one character gay and Lila, because I feel now we've moved on. It's now the B is there in the LGBTQ, so the B has been added there.
You described almost a little bit of a, well, why not? Lila doesn't have a problem. Lila's not confused. She's like, oh, that's what I am. I like sex. I like the person I'm with. Yeah, and that's it. There's something lovely about being able to just create that in a film, even if we're not always there in real life.
You know, just now I just came off of a festival in New York called Real Abilities, and this is the first time this happened to me, but it was shocking, where somebody from the audience just was angry and said, she's actually not bisexual. She's just dying to have sex, and she couldn't have it, and so she had sex with a woman, and she should not call herself bisexual. And I was blown away. I was like, wow, you can interpret it how you want, but I feel you're being judgmental. She feels she's bisexual, and if a person is saying what they are, it's their sexuality.
This is Abby Dees, and we've been talking about the new feature film Margarita with a Straw with writer and director Shonali Bose and the film star Kelki Kekla.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Carol Myers, Jason Proctor, and Abby Dees contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, like a generous anonymous donor from the WREK Atlanta area, all of whom helped make this program possible. Check out the latest show information and a lot more at thiswayout.org. Email TWORadio@AOL.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 5KIX Kangaroo Island, South Australia, KDUR Durango, Colorado, WRUV Burlington, Vermont, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.